It's great to see you all, and hope in very near future we get time to really get along together. So neurocanonical transformation, this was like a pre-pandemic work, and it all continues along the past 3 years. So I'd like to tell you about the story and some ideas around it and some partial result. So there's a dinosaur here because I view this as a modern extension of some ancient technique. So let me remind ourselves about let's remind ourselves about the classical Hamiltonian dynamics. So those are the two equations. You see, it's quite symmetric. If you combine momentum and coordinate together into something called the phase space variable. And by the way, if you define something called a symplectic metric, you're going to see that you can combine these two equations into one equation. So it actually reveals that the Hamiltonian equation is actually a gradient flow in the phase space. It's actually quite a special kind of a flow because it has no doubt, it has no, it's rotational free. It's also divergence free, where you can observe from the mathematical structure. So this very symmetric mathematical structure was discussed intensively in this famous book called Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics by Arnold. And such a mathematical structure actually had a direct consequence for numerical studies of Hamiltonian systems. That was most of them was first kind of implemented and revealed by Professor Kang Feng, also from Chinese Academy of Sciences, and his colleagues. So essentially the idea was if you simply discretize the Hamiltonian equation and try to integrate the system, for example, our sun, earth, moon, and systems like that, you're going to see that the integration was not stable. After a while, those planets, they just fly away to infinite point. However, if you use the so-called symplectic integrator, meaning that you respect that symmetry in the Hamiltonian equation, you are going to preserve energy and the whole thing is stable. So then this was quite important for molecular dynamics, also for astrophysics studies. So this is one aspect of simplicity. So the other aspect of the property is related to something called canonical transformation. I'm sure we all learned that in classical mechanics. So let me remind you. So essentially, canonical transformation is a change of variable between a set of phase space variables to another set of phase space variables. However, it is not an arbitrary change of variable. The Jacobian of that change of variable should be orthogonal with respect to that symplectic matrix we introduced. So this is a mathematical statement. People call that symplectic condition. So it actually just a generalized orthogonal condition we all know for orthogonal group or unitary condition. So it's called symplectic. But the physical meaning of that was that if for a symplectic change of variable, after the transformation, you're going to still have Hamiltonian dynamics. So in the transformed space, you can still talk about Hamiltonian function and Hamiltonian dynamics for the transformed variable. So in the machine learning terminology, let's call that it preserves Hamiltonian dynamics in the latent phase space after the transformation. So this is canonical transformation in machine learning language. So canonical transformation, probably we all remember that it enable us to simplify or sometimes even solve, completely solve Hamiltonian systems. For example, this was an attempt by Charles Dunaway in 18th century, where he actually tried to analytically identify canonical transformation so he can simplify the moon, earth, sun, three-body problem. So he produced actually 1800 pages of notes like that. Essentially, the idea was to perturbatively derive the transformation order by order. So nowadays, when we look at such a heroic efforts, I think it's very natural to us to ask the following question. How should we find out useful canonical transformations for even more complex systems like many-body systems? So the way to proceed actually comes from a change of perspective. So because up to this point, I was talking about canonical transformations from the perspective of Hamiltonian dynamics, where the central player was Hamiltonian function, Hamiltonian. But we all know that in free space, suppose we are in a finite temperature, at a finite temperature. So for any energy function or Hamiltonian function, there is a related canonical distribution, which is a Boltzmann distribution. So in that word, if you do change your variable to your Hamiltonian function, you are also going to induce a transformation to the probability distribution. So this is, I call this probabilistic perspective to the canonical transformation. But remember that canonical transformation is a special kind of coordinate transformation. So that means there is a constraint on the transformation you can do to the probabilities. Now, fast forward to now to deep learning age, we all know that deep neural networks, they are really good at transforming random variables and transforming probability densities. That's what those deep generative models was doing, right? So there are large families of deep generative models, and many of them actually already find applications in many-body physics. And for canonical transformation, we are going to use one kind of them. Not surprisingly, it's normal thing flow. I guess you all heard about that. Actually, yeah, you might or actually have made use of it. So in essence, normal thing flow is actually quite simple. So it's a change of variable to inputs using a neural networks. So this was already interesting even for a neural network with one neuron, okay? For a neural network with one neuron, the input is only one variable. Suppose it follows the normal distribution. But the this one neural network already strains the space make to produce a bimodal distribution, which appears to be more interesting. So the mass behind it is basically this change of probability measure formula, why this Jacobian of the transformation. So normal thing flow just does this kind of transformation in high dimensional space in a learnable way. So for the following discussion, I'm going to mention one, I would say extension, or let's say one limit, also very elegant limit of normal thing flow called continuous normal thing flow. So here it's the same formula for the probability density transformation, but I just take logarithmic on both sides of the equation. So now suppose this transformation is infinitesimal. So I just change a little bit to my input. So then there is a infinitesimal variable, let's call this epsilon. So then putting this infinitesimal change of variable into the equation and expand this log determinant using the famous equation, log determinant equals to trace log, right? We all use that in field theory. So you're going to, then you take epsilon goes to zero limit. So you're going to discover two sets of equations. The first one, of course, that the evolution of your variable or data follows an ordinary differential equation, at each time there is a velocity field drives you along the way. That's a depth direction. That's the transformation of the neural network. So the other thing is the ordinary differential equation for the probability density of your data. That follows another equation that is related to the divergence of your velocity field. So essentially in the continuous time limit, so what you need to parameterize was velocity. Velocity was parameterized by your neural network. And then use that to drive your data, and the likelihood will evolve along with data. So this actually has a nice physical picture related to fluid physics. So that's a same equation here. But notice that when I integrate such an equation, I'm actually moving along with the particle, let's say data themselves. So in that sense, this dxdt, d log p dt thing, was something called, is corresponds to something called the material derivative or substance derivative, because you are moving along with your fluid. So then you can expand this with partial derivatives with respect to time and space. So putting this material derivative inside the equation, you can rewrite the whole thing as a partial differential equation. So notice that this is ODE, this is the partial differential equation. Again, there's nothing unfamiliar to physicists, I guess, because this is a Lagrangian for a kind of a perspective to fluid physics. This is Euler's perspective. In Euler's perspective, you look at field, and this equation is nothing but a continuity equation for fluid density. But now we view fluid density a certain kind of a probability distribution. And what is a normal thing flow? We can really imagine a normal thing flow as some kind of a fluid control problem. So initially you have a kind of a fluid with a simple density, and you just dump that, put such a fluid into some pipe where you can design velocity, or let's say design the channels in of the pipe, and let it flow for some time. In the end, you are going to get some fluid with a complex density. This is normal thing flow, okay, in a continuous fluid perspective. So we are going to make use of such a perspective later on when we apply that back to many body physics. So now, bear with me. The goal was to design an symplectic transformation in phase space. So phase space contains P and Q, right? Momentum and coordinate. And the goal was to simplify Hamiltonian dynamics towards something simpler. So for physicists, I guess the simplest kind of a prototype was a harmonic oscillator. So the phase space density corresponding to an harmonic oscillator is nothing but the Gaussian distribution. So here is the basic idea, right? What I'm showing you is actually a normal thing flow in phase space. But there is an additional constraint. The constraint was that this normal thing flow should be a symplectic flow. That's it. That's neural canonical transformation. And in these slides, there are two things that are learnable. So one thing is, of course, the transformation themselves. We're going to talk about how to make a normal thing flow symplectic later on. So the other thing was the frequency in the latent space harmonic oscillators, independent harmonic oscillators. So why I'm putting additional learnable parameters here? That was because there is such a kind of intuition. Canonical transformation respect Hamiltonian dynamics. That means for any kind of given transformation, so suppose I integrate the Hamiltonian dynamics in the physical space, also I'm integrating the Hamiltonian dynamics in the latent space. At any time, these two dynamics, they are synchronized. I can do transformations back and forth. So that means, suppose I put additional parameters, frequency parameters in the latent space, I'm going to have a chance to learn certain collective variables, capital Q, that are nonlinear, non-local functions of original microscopic physical variables. But on the other hand, and in the same time, they're also going to correspond to different modes, motions with different frequency. So I hope that in the end, I can kind of automatically separate motions with different frequency. What was the purpose of putting additional parameters that are learnable there? So that's the basic setup. So natural question is how to build up symplectic neural network. So I think this aligns perfectly with kind of a deep learning like thinking, because simplicity is a group property, meaning you can compose many primitives into a larger neural network that is still symplectic. So the goal is really to identify and to discover symplectic primitives. Okay, where are those primitives? They are in our textbooks. For example, symplectic transformation is a Lie group if you restrict that to linear transformation. So you can cook up some symplectic Lie algebra. The other thing we learned was that any Hamiltonian evolution is a symplectic transformation, it's a canonical transformation. That means you can actually parameterize arbitrary scalar function as your Hamiltonian, then use that Hamiltonian to drive a transformation. That was also possible. But for the next kind of a 30 minutes or so, I'm only going to limit myself to one even more specific kind of transformation that is called the point transformation. So, because remember, a generic symplectic transformation can even mix momentum and coordinate. But for application and for understanding purpose, I don't want that to happen. For point transformation, the transformed coordinate is only going to be a function of the original coordinate. So this is why it's called a point transformation. So I'm only going to talk about this restricted class of canonical transformations. So the momentum will simply be transformed, let's say, covariantly along with the coordinate. So there are actually many examples of that. For example, we'll transform from Cartesian coordinate to polar coordinate. You might remember there was some funny PR stuff. Or if you go to spherical coordinate, that's all corresponding to point transformations. By the way, the implementation of such class, restricted class of transformation can be quite simple, because this is an arbitrary invertible transformation between coordinate. And that one was just a VJP, vector Jacobian product induced by the coordinate transformation. So you can, this the whole thing can be implemented just very simply. So that's the framework. And how it's going to be useful? Let's play around with a few examples, try to build up an intuition about the method. So it's a warm up. That's a simplest example, harmonic chain. So we know it's Hamiltonian. It's very simple. Actually, this is exactly solvable by normal mode transformations. But suppose I put this Hamiltonian into the framework. So this is what we are going to obtain. So the learned frequency, those dots, will be perfectly aligned, at least in the low energy part, be perfectly aligned with the analytical solution, okay? And then when you look at this low frequency modes, right? We can ask the question like, what's the meaning of the learned transformation? To answer that question, one way of addressing that was to look at the Jacobian of the transformation. Let's say we pick the slowest mode, we pick the coordinate of the slowest mode and compute its Jacobian. You're going to say that's nothing but all these cosine, sine, normal modes. So it's not actually, it's actually not surprising, right? Because we know for this particular example, by doing a normal mode transformation, you diagonalize your Hamiltonian and transform the system into an isolated harmonic oscillator with different frequency. So in that sense, the framework we set up with this learnable normalizing flow just to reproduce a linear transformation. We all know neural network, of course, they can reproduce linear transformation. So in that sense, this is a like consistency check. So, okay. Now let's move on to something more interesting. Another dipeptide. This is a small kind of a dipeptide. So that's a building block of protein. And we get 250 nanosecond of molecular dynamics data as our kind of a training data for density estimation of the phase space flow. So those data, if you make a video, you're just going to see 3 hours of kind of jigging around of those molecules, of these atoms. And if you treat each snapshot of this video as a sample and perform a density estimation using that model, this is what you are going to learn. So first of all, you are going to learn a certain kind of frequency out of that molecule. Already you notice that now I'm using logarithmic scale to plot the frequency. That means in that molecule, even though it has a more or less a similar number of degree of freedom, there are already emergent slow modes. Or let's say a separation between fast degree of freedom and a slow degree of freedom. Okay. Certainly for that molecule, the faster degree of freedom was like a jiggling around a faster oscillation between atoms on the bond. And then there was some global, more coherent motion corresponding to these slow modes, slow motions. And the thing was that for this molecule, the interaction was not harmonic. So that means the identified slow modes, they are not going to be linear transformation of the original coordinate. So taking Jacobian out of this transformation wouldn't directly reveal what's going on there. But we can, like in the machine learning way, right? We just do interpolation of these molecules. The idea is that in the latent space, we take the slowest coordinate, let's say capital Q1, and we just move around this one variable. We only move one variable in the latent space and use the inverse of transformation to map back to the original space, see what's going on in the like small Q space. So by doing so, you are going to see that these two slow modes, they correspond to a global rotation of the molecule along its backbone. So more or less, they correspond to these two slowest modes, they correspond to these two torsion angles, phi and psi. People actually give them name phi and psi because for typical analysis of this type of dipeptide or even protein, a famous plot to make was to project all the conformations down to this two-dimensional plane. They look at different so-called conformations. And what we just achieved was an data-driven dimensional reduction to the space of slow collective variables. And for this particular case, that two variables, we call it capital Q1 and capital Q2, they had quite strong correlations to phi and psi, but they are not identical to 500%. And by the way, we can also identify the third one and so on. For those two, those things, probably there is no simple physical understanding because they correspond to more complex motions. But nevertheless, even if there is no human understanding, for certain kind of downstream tasks, for example, enhanced sampling or control, identifying those slow modes would already be useful. So that's a second example. So the third one was like more, crazy one because it was like simply by an analog. Probably there's no really theory behind the analog, but it just you would say we play that just simply for fun. So that's the famous amnest thing. But when you look at those kind of digits, the conventional way of viewing that was really view them as a kind of a grayscale images with like lots of pixels. But when you look at those things, let's for the time being call them amnest molecules, because I really want to kind of make a connection or make an analog between these kind of different conformations of the small molecule towards this digital class. So imagine we have 784 kind of tiny atoms, and they form 10 different conformations, happens to be these digits. So that means we can apply the same kind of machinery to amnest and see what will happen to amnest. So first of all, for amnest, certainly there was no Hamiltonian behind it, but imagine there was a Hamiltonian. Imagine there was a kind of a, let's say, the universe of God. Someone generate those conformations. I mean, it's the conformation is with certain kind of unknown Hamiltonian function, but and we can carry out the same transformation, simplicity transformation in the such a phase space towards some kind of a harmonic oscillator. And the first thing you are going to get was something called a dispersion. You're going to get something called dispersion of amnest. So it corresponds to how many slow modes there are there in the amnest Hamiltonian. So, but immediately you observe that there is only like 10% of slow modes out of 784. Only a small portion of them are slow. Okay. Then once you have such a transformation that separates slow and fast degree of freedoms of amnest pixels, you can make use of them for example, for compression and for transmission of imaging and so on. This is just like a game we played. We call this the neural Alice Bob game. Imagine Alice has many digits. She tries to send her digits to Bob via some channel. In the channel, she only sends a few number of slow modes. The other things, Bob needs to kind of sample from random noise to make up for this fast modes. So this is basic setup. The thing was we want to understand by sending Bob how many slow modes Bob can kind of recover those amnest kind of a conformation. Okay, so my guess would be, my intuition would be, you only need to send a few, really a few slow modes to recover the thing. So here is actually an experiment. So that's one out of 784. That means Alice only sends Bob one variable. All the remaining kind of signals Bob sends samples randomly from Gaussian noise. So in that sense, what on the Bob side is simply an kind of a general model that samples from almost a random variable. So it's only one controlled, let's say clapped variable. Of course, it does not match Alice. But when Alice sends more and more slow modes to Bob, you see, with only 15 out of 784, you almost recover the thing. So this actually confirms the, I would say, physicist kind of intuition that slow modes, slow random, slow motions captures the essence, or let's say the actual physical meaning, or let's say the conformations of nature data. So that's the third experiment. Yeah, please, Sebastian, you had a question, right? Please.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So I was just wondering, do you train all numbers at the same time, or do you find neural transformations for each of these numbers? Because I could imagine that each number has different frequencies that are optimal. And another thing is then, have you compared this to autoencoders or PCA?
Yeah. So in this experiment, we train all the numbers together because of the picture I mentioned in the beginning, because I really view them as different conformations. So it would be interesting, actually, as you suggested, to separate them into different classes and see what's going on, right? See what are those frequencies? We didn't do that experiment. So the other thing was compared the whole thing to PCA. So PCA is a linear transformation, but this is a nonlinear one. Probably you meant variational autoencoder, or let's say autoencoder kind of thing. It's kind of closer to this setup. But I would like to make comment that in a usual autoencoder setup, you need to first specify the dimensionality in the latent space. And after training, usually there's no way to kind of rank importance of different latent variables. So a similar experiment in autoencoder setup would be you train separate different autoencoders with a different dimensionality for the kind of a latent space, and then compare them together. But in the present setup, it was like training the whole thing and rank them using frequency. And by the way, the comment on PCA was actually quite relevant, because in PCA there was a similar trick, something called explained variance, where people can still rank importance of those variables. But unfortunately, PCA was like a linear transformation. Very often it was not sufficient to capture nonlinear dependence. Okay. Yeah, good. Then, mentioning some coherent work, because the week we posted that paper, actually we didn't notice that. But later on we noticed that it was like the week of iClear submission. So there were lots of actually concurrent papers with, you see, Hamiltonian, symbiotic. At least you see, wow, that was already like 3 years ago. It was like a wave of work where people pay attention to such a kind of connection between flows, Hamiltonians with structures and so on. So yeah, if you're interested, you can also check those works. Yeah, they had a different, sometimes different perspective on the things. Okay, cool. Then I guess, let me move on, because I don't perhaps I'm going to skip some of the part because I don't want to go over time too much, but this part I think would be also interesting, because up to this point I was talking about purely about classical systems. So how about quantum systems? Can we extend the framework to quantum systems solving actual hard quantum manifold systems? That was a question I'm keep wondering over years. So first we need to clarify some basic terminology, because the word canonical transformation actually means different things in classical and quantum world. As we saw in classical world, it actually means symplectic. It's a structure of the transformation, it's Jacobian. And usually in quantum world, the word canonical corresponds to unitary. Okay, so that means it looks like they means different things, but actually they are closely connected, because this was related to something in the early days of quantum mechanics, where people really try to connect classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. They literally take many of the classical canonical transformation and quantize them by viewing those momentum and coordinate variables as operators. So in that sense, all the kind of canonical transformations I talk about up to this point can be quantized. So taking point transformation as an example, this is a generator for the point transformation, but if you kind of symmetrize X and P, and you are going to make a Hermitian operator, this operator actually plays the role of Hamiltonian, and use this Hamiltonian, you can generate an time evolution, or let's say unitary transformation to your coordinate and momentum. That's kind of a quantum counterpart of canonical transformation. So in the classical setup, we parametrize such a velocity field, or let's say we parametrize the transformation in momentum space, in the coordinate space. And in the quantum world, the thing we need to do similarly to parametrize this velocity kind of term in the generator of the unitary transformation. So this is at least formally what you can do if you want to extend the whole thing to quantum. By the way, there are many other things that are parallel in classical and quantum world. So in the quantum world, we talk about density matrix. That's a kind of extension of probability we talk up to this point. And then there are ways to measure similarity between two density matrices. And there is a variational free energy, even for density matrix. They are all kind of extensions of what we already know for the classical systems. So what an canonical transformation in a quantum setup offers you is actually a way to parametrize density matrix. So this is the message. Remember, in the classical world, what we did was to choose certain kind of a simple base probability density, usually it's a Gaussian distribution, then perform transformation to that base distribution to produce a variational density, that's a variational probability density. And the quantization of this kind of idea offers you a way to select, or let's say parametrize, some simple base density matrix, then evolve such a base density matrix with a parametrized unitary. In the end, you achieved certain variational density matrix. So this is value of such a extension. And usually, if we write down an arbitrary kind of a unitary transformation parameterized as a Hamiltonian, we are not going to be able to simulate, for example, time evolution. However, here it's different because here this generator has a very special form. It was in this form because this is P. If you really look at this equation, and if you take a derivative of this equation, I'm going to see that if the evolution of this of the wave function and this generator is nothing but the continuity equation. And the continuity equation of the wave function we saw in the very beginning in the introduction to the continuous normalizing flow. So that means the evolution of such a and such a unitary operator can be efficiently simulated just by integrating ordinary differential equations. So this offers us an ability to carry out variational free energy calculations for many body systems. So as an example, let me show you an application to uniform electron gas. This is a really prototype example of interacting electrons. So kinetic energy, Coulomb repulsive interaction, nothing else. And then there's only one parameter in this problem. This is IS, describing the average distance between electrons. So depending on IS, the system can have a different phases and so on. And uniform electron gas was a fundamental model for metals. And also the equation of state of it is relevant to, for example, density functional calculations. So people care about such a very simple kind of a problem. However, for such a prototype model, there was something still controversial. This is something called quasi-particle effective mass. So we all know that at the finite, let's say small IS or intermediate IS, uniform electron gas should be a Fermi liquid with a renormalized quasi-particle. And this quasi-particle, the value of this quasi-particle controls many other physical properties. However, you see, this was really over like 50 years of study. There are many, many attempts. So the early days of diagrammatic expansions, you see, those curves, they do not kind of agree even qualitatively. And that was studied 2 years ago with Monte Carlo calculations for excited state. It was supposed to really finally solve this question. For example, it was reported that's the dependence of the quasi-particle mass with respect to IS. However, there was another kind of a should be unbiased method called a variational diagrammatic Monte Carlo calculations, so which produce this kind of prediction. So you see, these still differ with each other. So the issue was not actually not solved, and this was not an academic problem because in two-dimensional space, people can actually produce uniform electron gas. But then there was also a puzzle in from the experimental side because some experiment reported enhanced effective mass, others reported suppressed, meaning whether the effective mass is greater or smaller than the bare electron mass. So you see it's a mess, 2D, 3D, spinful, spinless, lots of discussions. And with that variational density matrix kind of approach, we try to address this problem by looking at low temperature thermodynamics. Because according to Landau Fermi liquid theory's prediction, at a sufficiently low temperature, entropy, or let's say specific heat, is linearly proportional to the temperature. And the per factor is effect mass. So that means if you had a way to compute low temperature entropy of uniform electron gas sufficiently accurate, then the ratio of your entropy with respect to the ideal Fermi gas entropy will give you the signal. So this is the approach, let's say the routine we are going to follow. So this was more like following the kind of observable, physical observable, instead of looking at all those diagrammatics and so on. And it appears to be quite straightforward. However, this was not actually carried out even in those diagrammatic, in those Monte Carlo, diffusion Monte Carlo calculations, because there was no reliable method to study those intacting electron systems in continuity at a sufficiently low temperature. So Monte Carlo would have some problem as well. So, and the kind of methodology we are going to take was this variational free energy approach. So you see there are many names associated with such a variational principle. So essentially it's quite straightforward. It's like ground state variational Monte Carlo extended to finite temperature. Now the central object is not a wave function, but a density matrix. But then there are many constraints to your density matrix, right? So that makes it kind of a more complex, because for wave function, you just need to parameterize a function, but for density matrix, you need to care about its structure. Luckily, as we show in the previous slide, neural canonical transformation offers us a way to parameterize density matrix, just like normalization flow can offers us a way to parameterize a variational probability density. So that's the basic kind of idea for such kind of calculation. I realize I'm almost over time, so let me be quick. The plan was I'm going to introduce to you the components, then I'm going to switch to the end. So because to parameterize density matrix, there are two things to care about. Because density matrix consists of a kind of a classical aspect, that's a probability distribution over those state. The other thing was there are many body orthonormal bases. So now to parameterize a variational density matrix, we just parameterize these two things individually with two kinds of neural network. For the first thing, since it's a classical, we just then use, for example, autoregressive neural network kind of stuff. So, by the way, I learned also from Huang's paper, but since there's not much time, as to not go into details. And for the wave function part, we use the idea of kind of a canonical transformation as a unitary transformation. Essentially, starting from quasi-particle coordinate, we follow certain kind of evolution all the way to electron coordinate, and make sure this evolution is unitary, so you respect the orthonormal condition, right? The wave functions of quasi-particle, they are plane wave state. Certainly, they are also normal. But if you do unitary transformation, these states, they are also normal. That's a basic idea. There are some physical pictures behind it, but I don't think I have enough time to cover them. The upshot was this calculation was possible, at least for two-dimensional systems, where there were already some debate, right, from experimental side. But look, this calculation reveals that the effect mass is suppressed compared to the suppressed compared to the bare electron gas for spin polarized case. So that means these two kind of experiment, we agree with this one, not with this one. There might be something wrong. There should be something wrong with this experiment. Perhaps valid degree of freedom. Okay. And we also collect predictions together with some other predictions. It's all over Araba, so we believe our prediction should be more kind of reliable. At least we had a way to systematically improve them. If we improve the rational answers, improve the system science, and so on. So it's kind of a more clean prediction because it's based on the observable instead of manipulating many those excited states and so on. I'm really sorry for go over time. That's the kind of a status. So neural canonical transformations extension to quantum systems offer us a way to study finite temperature many electron systems with a kind of an ab initio ability, because it's all about continuous degree of freedom. So it's going to be able to study those kinds of problems with a rational free energy approach, where standard Monte Carlo suffers from sign problem. So these are the things that I'm care about at the moment. Yeah. So thank you for your attention. Yeah.
Questions here. Don't worry about going over. We have nothing better to do.
Okay.
Yeah, what were all your FAQs there? Was there something that you rushed through?
Hmm. Sorry.
I was just saying, while we're taking questions, do you want to throw up your slide that said FAQs? Didn't you have
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Let me. So I think those things are already common knowledge to us, but let me just say a little bit about, because those are really FAQs that, question I got all the time. One thing is about black box thing. Yeah, actually, I think that's also a good chance for us to kind of chat a bit about how do we see these models, right? From my perspective, for those kind of rational ground state or rational free energy calculation, I sometimes really don't care about what the model is doing as long as it's sufficiently accurate. So I don't care about all these neurons and so on. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part was at least for the electron gas example, actually, those components in the density matrix, they are actually very physical. So for example, I'm using the whole framework to study Fermi liquid, right? I'm not crazy enough to study non-Fermi liquid because I don't think it's going to work. It's Fermi liquid because then there is a adiabatic continuity actually that fits normalization flow, I mean, the computational tool very well. So I'm actually talking about particle, quasi-particle in the latent and in the physical space. The other thing was this autoregressive model that I skipped over. This autoregressive model parameterizes the occupation in the diagonalized quasi-particle space. But what's the meaning of those things? Actually, this log P of K, I haven't looked at them, but they have to match Landau's energy functional if Landau was right, because it's really the same thing. Yeah. So in that sense, I would say in the electron gas example, perhaps I'm lucky because it's actually not a black box model. Those components have physical meaning. Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Maybe also, can you comment on I was talking to people at Flatiron, we work on normalizing flows for like lattice gauge theories, and Michael Albergo and them, they were saying that I think it's, you called it your like G theta, right? Can you comment on how hard that is to learn? The actual learning part of the procedure? Is that the bottleneck? Is that what will kind of like stop you from scaling eventually? Right. Or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at a certain point, I skipped a little bit about the way to learn the thing. So actually, there are two ways to learn the flow. As we all know, the forward and reverse kind of a thing, right? Depending on whether you have Newtonian or whether you have data. And for the second part, this variational free energy calculations, I'm actually doing variational calculations. And also for Michael's, many of the lattice gauge theory calculation where they do not assume they already have data, they only have the action. So it's all this kind of learning. And for this kind of learning, it can be quite problematic if you really go to large systems or if the system is glassy, because you're going to trap at local minimum, and you're going to get a distribution that is narrower than the true distribution. So this can be problematic for a really large. And on the other hand, if you do density estimation with a flow, conventionally, even for quite advanced so-called continuous flows, people usually do maximal likelihood estimation. That means they integrate all over the flow to do density estimation. Again, this can be very expensive. But nowadays, there are new options to train such a continuous flow. There are actually three, I think, concurrent papers, last four for iClear 2023. They have different names, rectified flow or flow matching and so on. Essentially, the idea was to borrow the key idea from diffusion model. So people randomly sample time in the flow and train the velocity field instead of train the likelihood. To my understanding, this will greatly boost normalizing flow as a generative model. At a certain point, I even try to make the prediction that now continuous normalization flow will surpass diffusion model for generative modeling. So, but there's a caution. So it's all for the case of training with data. Once you have data, you can do this kind of training, because in a nutshell, diffusion model can also be translated to a continuous Lamassine flow, because there is a probability flow framework. So in that sense, I think Lamassine flow has great potential. We just do not have the right way to unlock that potential in the past. Yeah.
Thanks. Other questions?
Can I go? Hey, Lei Wang.
Hi, hello.
So maybe a curiosity. So you have this very beautiful way of writing the density matrix, right? Like in terms of this dynamics of the fermions, right? that you can integrate efficiently, right? So is that specific to continuous systems, or can you do it also for discrete systems? Because you have the other paper for discrete systems, but using quantum computers, but the kind of like this dynamics can be carried out in the quantum computer. But is there an analogous discrete variable parametrization that satisfy all these requirements?
Yeah, great question. That's also a question I'm asking to myself. somehow here, so this I would say perhaps I didn't tell the story in a very clear way, but nevertheless, this magic really ties closely to continuous variable thing. Oh, okay. So there's X and P. Suppose I put the whole thing to the lattice, I wouldn't have this such a kind of a continuous something flow and so on. So in that sense, suppose I try to apply the whole machinery to Harvard model, the best thing I can think of here, I put some parametrized free fermion kind of tri density matrix. Here, I do some parametrized unitary transformation. But then to evaluate expectations, I have to kind of deal with certain commutators. Then I perhaps do some CSH typed perturbative expansion and so on. So I'm losing many of the elegant properties of a continuous something flow.
I see. Okay, thanks. Yeah, great.
Yeah, hope to see you soon.
Yeah, I hope to see you soon too.
Other questions? For the renormalized mass, you know what I mean, in the Fermi liquid theory. I think if you read this old essay by Laughlin and Pines that like discusses emergence, this is what they cite, right? You know, how do you, from ab initio, you know, calculations, calculate the renormalized mass of the quasi-particle? Now, you know, it's a big open problem. But so, you know, you show that your renormalized mass is going down as a function of that, of the inter-electron distance, right? Yeah. So isn't that known in the large RS limit for different, you know, just like, you know, I guess experimental results? Or is it not? I mean, you said there's this kind of debate between whether it gets larger or smaller, right?
Oh, okay. So here, actually, there are several things. So, whether the system is 2D or 3D matters, that's one thing. The other thing was whether the system was spin polarized or spin unpolarized also matters. So here, I'm only solving one part of the puzzle related to that pair of experiment. That was for two-dimensional spin polarized case, okay? So it was definitely suppressed. However, for example, for two-dimensional spin unpolarized case, then again, there was a debate. That debate was in Sapley's textbook. I don't know. We hope we can carry out certain calculations in future. So that's the second one. Then this pair of things, that's for three-dimensional spin unpolarized case. But for that, we haven't get machine to run, because then suddenly it's three-dimensional systems. I have to at least have, for example, around 100 electrons so that I have a more or less round sphere-like Fermi surface. So at the moment, we haven't touched three-dimensional electron gas debate.
What's that? What's the spot on the left?
Left.
Yeah, Hayden or whatever. What, the 1965 calculation? Is that a calculation?
Yeah, yeah. That's a GW kind of a calculation. This one, that's Harding's calculation. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
For three dimensional case. So this one, wow, it does not agree with this. Yeah. No. That's for three dimensional spin unpolarized case. Yeah.
Other questions for Lei Wang? If not, I think we should maybe thank Lei Wang once more.